My name is Solis. I am a grateful recovering co-alcoholic, privileged to be a member of the Worldwide Fellowship of the Al-Anon Family Groups. I want to thank the committee for asking me to come spend this weekend with you. It's a tremendous joy to be here and meet all these new people. That's the best part about attending conferences, making new friends. And so I really want to thank Ariella for helping me, picking me up at the airport and being the most amazing hostess. And I want to echo the sentiment about applauding the entire committee. Quite simply, service is love made visible. And so this committee has demonstrated to you their love for the fellowship and for all of you by working so hard to put on such a wonderful conference. Where are my Alateens? They are here somewhere? Awesome, I see some hands over here, that's great. I wanna thank you for your presence here. You're the lifeblood of recovery, and your presence here touches us and provides us with hope in ways that you can't perhaps yet understand. I know that sometimes it's difficult to listen to us reminisce about the good old days. Just know that you're living them now, so pay attention. I say that because when I went to my very first meeting, June 10th, 1984, I was 19 years old. And I introduced myself this evening as a co-alcoholic because when I came into the program in 1984, that's how we identified ourselves. Terminology like adult child or codependent hadn't really come around yet. And I really like the term co-alcoholic because I think it really sort of conveys my relationship to the alcoholic in a way that makes sense to me. I've heard many speakers, including last night's speaker, talk about the idea when mom's having a good day, we're all having a good day. And when mom's having a bad day, we're all having a bad day. And so I'm along this ride with the alcoholic, and sometimes that's a little bit challenging. I want to say that I too am a real visual person. I understand things much better, especially from a historical perspective, when there's imagery involved. And so I asked the committee if they would indulge me tonight because I brought slideshow. I guess we're going to put it right up here. So if you will follow along with me, I'm going to tell you a little bit about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. So the very first slide you'll see is the Capitol Dome of Sacramento, California. Sacramento is where I'm from, it's where I was born and where I was raised. Here's a picture of my family. You'll see in height order, I am the oldest of five. I was adopted into a Mexican-American Catholic family. You'll see that my mother there on the end is the one with a beverage in her hand. She is the original alcoholic that brought me to the doors of Al-Anon. Since I've gotten into recovery, I've met many more alcoholics, but she was the original. You'll also notice that my father was not in that picture. When I was very early age, he had said that he was leaving and that I was the man of the house and responsible to take care of my mother and the family. And I think I might have been like 8 or 9 years old at that time. And that was a tall order, but I really was, I mostly feared my father. And so I really took what he said to heart. And on that day, I began my journey of an overdeveloped sense of responsibility. And so it was my job to make sure that everything was all right. My mother was a single mother of five children, and it was a very difficult life and a very difficult time for her. And so when she would work long hours, she took every opportunity for overtime that she could get. So she would work long hours, and when she would start her drinking was when she would call to say that she was going to stop with coworkers on the way home and have a beer. And then she was usually home right after that. But for any of you all familiar with the disease of alcoholism, you know that it's a progressive one. And so progressively, the time that she took to get home was longer and longer. And I'll never forget that first night that she didn't come home at all. And I remember waking up the next morning and my little brothers and sisters running around asking, "Where's mom? Where's mom?" And I said, "Oh, well, you know, she had to get up early this morning and go to work, so she's already gone, but we'll see her tonight." I learned in that moment that I was going to have to learn how to lie, and I was going to have to be convincing about it, and it might be on the fly at a moment's notice, and it better be a good one. And it was so that you would be okay. Whether I was okay or not was immaterial, because I was terrified. I didn't know where my mother was. I didn't know what had happened. I didn't know who to call. I didn't know what you should do. It was before the days of 911. I mean, I was freaked out. But as long as you were okay, that's what was important. So, next slide. Me in high school. And because it's a rigorously honest program, I will tell you, I took advantage of Photoshop with that picture. I was not a cheerleader in high school. But see, if I can paint a vision for you, that's what I would want you to see. Me surrounded by adoring classmates, having a good time. Here are the real pictures. Okay, so that's me upside down in a trash can, my feet sticking out the top. That's me being stuffed into a locker. Me running from an angry crowd. I grew up in high school and had characteristics that if you were being kind, you might call effeminate. But I will tell you that nobody was ever kind. So those weren't the names they called me. And so I spent most of my time trying to get from class to class without getting pummeled. And from a very early age, probably 12 or 13, I had taken a bunch of my mother's Valium and vodka and mixed it up in the blender and poured it into a peanut butter jar, and I put it in my sock drawer. And I want you to know that until I came into the program of Al-Anon, that was my higher power. I would pull it out from time to time when things got bad, and I would think, if I could drink this concoction, this pain will be over, this life will be over. And so I didn't have a way to cope. I threw myself into the church, I threw myself into other things, and none of those things seemed to help. When I graduated from high school, I moved out of the house right away. By this time, life was getting really crazy. My mother's alcoholism had developed significantly by this point, and now the family business had become a bar. My mother had bought a bar. So this was an escalation of her alcoholism, certainly, but the improvement was I knew now where she was all the time. And so it was hard on my brothers and sister when I left, because I was the caretaker. I was the one who cooked and cleaned and made sure the rent got paid and that there were groceries in the cupboard. I did all those things. And I was very resentful at my mother for a long time. I felt like she had robbed me from a life, but the truth was I didn't have a life. And so I had this bitter feeling that I couldn't explain or couldn't understand. And so I didn't have a life. It was 1981, so it was before the internet or apps or anything like that. And so I knew that I was gay, and I figured I would go to where gay people were, which would be a bar. So here's the first place I walked into, which turns out to be my first Al-Anon hunting grounds. Because it would appear that I was attracted to people who needed assistance. This overdeveloped sense of responsibility took me to some really dark places. My first boyfriend was a guy who we had so much in common. He drank scotch, I bought scotch. We had a lot in common. And I got to see what adult relationships were like. So it's probably a good time to introduce you to my drug of choice. So this gelatinous ooze is a chemical that runs throughout our body called adrenaline. When I have adrenaline flowing through me, I feel alive. I want to live in this moment forever, and I want to die at the same time. I love you to death, and I want to kill you at the same time. I have all these conflicting emotions, but I feel alive in a way that I've never felt before. So here's an interesting Al-Anon fact. Alcoholics are a great source of adrenaline. With some of them, it was like hitting the mother load. I'm like, oh yes, here we go. So I'm in these insane relationships. But the insanity at home is still going on. I'm getting calls. Mom's driven the car through the garage. The windows, they had a fight. Her and her boyfriend had a fight last night, and they busted out the windows. So I'm going home across town and taking care of things still periodically and still trying to manage my own affairs, for lack of a better word. And so I realized that I needed to get away from my family. I thought distance would take care of it. A geographic cure certainly would help in this situation. So I realized that I had a problem. The Capitol Dome of Sacramento, California. Sacramento was the problem. If I could get far enough away from my family, they wouldn't be dependent upon me for assistance, and I could have my own life. I desperately wanted my own life. So because I had no means of doing that, I did what seemed like a perfectly reasonable thing to do. That's me in a Navy outfit. I joined the United States Navy. Now, with that solution came problems, which is sort of my mode of operation. Solve one problem, create several more. I hadn't quite let go of this effeminate thing yet, nor have I still. And so the Navy and I didn't always see eye to eye on my behavior. And so, but it was kind of fun. That's me marching up and down the field, waving a flag. That's me twirling a rifle like it is the last baton on earth. Because I'm in the color guard. Oh my God, I got to be the cheerleader I always wanted to be in the United States Navy. And I am going to fabulous destinations, exotic places. That's Orlando, Florida. Meridian, Mississippi, Detroit, Michigan, join the Navy, see the world. And so, I'm in Detroit, Michigan now, and life looks very similar to Sacramento. I'm still being attracted to the same type of alcoholics, and now my circumstances are escalating. So I'm having situations like one guy who likes to hit me when he gets drunk. He's the one that tried to run me over the car one night. Had I not dove into a snowbank, you'd have another speaker this evening. Or at the very worst, I would have a Ford emblem implanted on my ass. And here's the thing, my mother in her escalation had gotten into abusive relationships. And I used to be so mad. Because the next day, it was like nothing happened, you know? And I would think, how is it that we're living on this merry-go-round called denial, and I'm getting dizzy? It's like, doesn't she see? Like, this is crazy. How could she get in these physical fights until 3 a.m, and then the next day, it's like nothing happened? Until I did it myself, and I got to see what it's like when you pretend like nothing happens. You know, the night he tried to run me over with the car, the next night we were at this really nice restaurant. You know, he'd bought me a dozen roses, and I thought, this is how it happens. This is exactly how it happens. Because what am I going to do? Where am I going to go? And besides, he needs me. Yeah. So I'm spending my time with these alcoholics. And I'm having trouble in the Navy. I'm having trouble in the Navy because I thought 1,700 miles would be far enough away, and it was not. So I'm still getting phone calls from the family, and the calls are getting worse. Like, mom's, you know, she shakes a lot. She had a hard time going to work this morning because she couldn't stop shaking. And now she's locked herself in the room, and she says she's not coming out. I would later learn in the program of Al-Anon that these were DTs that she was experiencing, but I didn't know that then. They just said, come home, and I said, I can't come home. So I came to work one day, and my chief petty officer was in my office, and he said, we are sending you home on emergency leave. He said, the Red Cross has called and said that you're having a family emergency and that you need to come home and deal with your family. And so, this is the escalation that it had gotten to. Prior to that, I had been going to counseling. The Navy offered counseling. And so I was seeing the command alcohol and drug counselor because I told my chief petty officer what was going on at home. And he said, that sounds like an alcohol-related problem. You need to go talk to the command drug and alcohol counselor. And so he was used to having alcoholics come in his office. And so, but I was in there talking about my family. And he said, you know, we're going to send you to the Al-Anon family groups. I'd never heard of this. I didn't know what it was. I said, what is that? He said, that is a place where it's for the friends and families of alcoholics. And so, and he had told me, it's where you go sometimes to learn how to make things better, is how he said it to me. And so I'm thinking, awesome. Oh my gosh, there's a place where we can go and get taught how to get them sober. I cannot wait, right? So at this Methodist church in downtown Detroit, in this very dreary basement, I walk in to these lovely ladies. You know, I'm 19 years old. I don't think any of them were under 40. And I just thought, oh my gosh, someone has made a mistake. Well, first I had gone into the other room where the AAs were meeting, and they said, oh no, you need to go across the hall. That's where the family groups is. And I said, okay. I had this little card I had to get signed off because the alcohol and drug counselor wanted verification that I went to the meeting. So I walked into the Al-Anon meeting and I saw all the ladies sitting there, and I said, I have this card that I need to have signed off. And they said, oh, you probably need to go to the other meeting. So right away I'm feeling like I'm in no man's land. Like, I don't have a place to go. They sent me over there and then they sent me over there. And so I explained, I'm looking for the Al-Anon family group. And they said, oh, then you're in the right place. Have a seat. So the first meeting, oh my gosh. Okay, so the woman who shared that night, she said, my name is so-and-so. I'm a grateful recovering co-alcoholic, and by the grace of God and the 12 steps of the Al-Anon program, I have not found it necessary to plan the homicide of another person in 4 years. That's a strand of pearls. Had I been wearing them that night, I would have been forced to clutch them because I could not believe she just said that. As many times as my alcoholic had made me irate, I don't think I'd ever planned her homicide. And there were other things I found very troubling. I waited, and we never got to the part about how we're supposed to get them sober. They had these things on the wall called the 12 steps, and I'm already looking them over very scrupulously. That one there, don't have any amends to make, don't have to do that one. I'm looking at all these going like, nope, 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 nope. I couldn't figure out why I was there. The only reason I went back the next night was because I knew they needed me. I know this because they told me at the end to please come back. The second night I went, they said, oh my gosh, we're so glad you came back. We were talking after you left the meeting last night, and we think that you would make a great group chairman. Would you be the group chairman? Now, I was frightened by the prospect, but also a little flattered, because, I mean, somebody finally had recognized my true abilities, and I said, what is involved with the chairman of the group? And they said, before the meeting, you take the chairs from out of the closet and you put them around the table. And after the meeting, you take them from around the table and you put them back in the closet. I was introduced to service. Now, I've had a love-hate relationship with service. But you need to know that it is the most amazing sense of belonging that I've ever had to anything when I'm in it. In fact, years later, when I was going through volumes of journals, because I had a sponsor who would make me write in journals, when I'd call him to complain about something, he'd say, what does your journal say? It doesn't say anything. I didn't write in it. Well, go do that first, and then call me back and read it to me. So I started writing in the journal, and I had volumes, and I was having an unhappy day years and years later, and had one of those statements come out of my mouth that was like something along the lines of, I've never been happy. And I was like, that's a lie. You have been happy. Go find happiness. So I'm looking through my journals. Okay, there's a happy day. smiley face, flip, flip, flip. Okay, there's a happy day, flip, flip. And then I began to look for the common denominators. I thought certainly it would have to do with how much money I was making, or certainly it would have to do with how good I was doing in my career, or certainly it would have to do with something along those lines. It turns out every single one of those pages was in direct correlation to how much I was in service and how much I was involved in the fellowship of the Al-Anon family groups. Who knew that was going to become the source of happiness years later? I didn't. I certainly didn't when I was 19 years old. So my recovery date in Al-Anon is November 3rd, 1984. Now, I told you that my first meeting was June 10th, 1984, but it wasn't until November 3rd that I surrendered. So I came in to that meeting and I put the chairs out, but I had a bad attitude about it. I still didn't think I needed to be there. I still had to get the little card signed off. So when I was standing in the office and that chief petty officer was telling me I was going to have to go home, by this time I'm a few months into Al-Anon, so I'm thinking, okay, I can do this. I'm in Al-Anon. I now know there's a meeting across the hall that my mother could go to, and I'm going to go home and I'm going to tell her the solution, and all will be well. So I flew home from Detroit all the way to California, 1,700 miles, and she was literally in bed having the DTs. And I want to tell you that I tried everything. I mean everything. See, before I had recovery, all I had was weapons of manipulation. That's it. That's all I had. So I used those. One, I'm the queen of silent scorn. Like, I can scream at you so silently, you won't even be able to tolerate it. I tried begging. I tried guilt. I tried shame. I tried pleading. We even played my favorite game, which is guess what I'm mad about. Nothing worked. I was home for all of 4 weeks, and she had shown slight improvement, but she was still not herself. And my family was mad at me. My family was mad at me because my mother and I have had a long relationship, me being the oldest, where I could get things out of her. I could get her to do things. I could get her to shape up. I could get her to get to the next thing, whatever that was. And I couldn't this time. And when I was on the plane ride back to Detroit, I started crying because I realized what they had been telling me in the Al-Anon program. And I hadn't realized the first step. Powerless over alcohol, my life had become unmanageable. I am powerless over the alcohol. I'm powerless over the alcoholic and what they do or what they don't do. And it didn't realize until that moment. The reason I really like the term co-alcoholic and still use it is because alcoholics talk about they get to that bottom where it just doesn't work anymore. No matter how much they drink, no matter how much they use, it doesn't have the effect that gave them the sense of relief that they always craved. And that's where my mother was. She was at her bottom. And as a co-alcoholic, I was at my bottom. My tools of manipulation did not work anymore. And so I had to find a new way of living. So I'm sitting on this airplane crying in my little dress blue outfit with this elderly lady handing me tissues going, there. But I knew when I got off that plane, I was gonna go right to the Al-Anon meeting. I'm thinking, okay, when I get off the plane, I can still make it to the 8 o'clock meeting. And I walked into that meeting and I surrendered, and that was November 3rd, 1984. I changed. I stopped calling the 12 steps the pool rules. I started actually calling my sponsor and getting together to work the steps. And it was slow at first, but there was a transformation that was taking place. And I couldn't see it yet. Of course, you can never really see it while you're in it. You can see it in retrospective. I could see that my life was changing. And I also knew after a period of time that I was suffering. I was going to the meetings. It was around this time, I should say, that I got arrested. Then NCIS came into my office one day and put me in handcuffs. And they charged me with homosexuality. This is the part you're all supposed to gasp. Right, thank you. Had I been wearing pearls that day, I would have been forced to clutch them because I could not believe they just did that to me. But they put me through an interrogation process, made me take off my clothes to show that I wasn't wearing women's underwear, and then I didn't shave my legs. And I like to tell people in my home group, thank God that day I wasn't. And it's a separate long story about how I made it through all of that. But after that, I became highly paranoid. I was convinced that the Navy was, you know, out to get me. And so, you know, I'm terrified of anonymity issues. I'm in meetings. I'm not wanting to use pronouns. I don't want to talk about what's going on at home. I'm afraid I'll say him instead of her, you know. And the truth is, you all never made me feel different, ever. No one ever shook a finger at me and said, you don't belong here. But you know how we are. You know how we are. I felt different. And just by virtue of that feeling, which are not facts, I separated myself from the group. So I started to slowly but surely withdraw from the Al-Anon. I'm still going to meetings, but I'm not really talking anymore. I'm not really doing the deal anymore. And there was this older woman, Mary, and an old Scottish woman who would sit in the corner and do her needlepoint. And I never really saw Mary's eyes because she was always looking down doing her needlepoint. And I got there early one night. She was the only one sitting there. And so I'm just being quiet, sitting there. And she said, how are you doing, dear? And I said, I'm okay. She said, you haven't talked in a while. And I said, I know. She said, you still having problems at home? And I said, yeah. She said, I suspect you've been hapless and hopeless, but I bet you've never been hymnless. And when she said that, I knew Mary knew. But it also gave me a sense of freedom that I was going to be okay, because Mary didn't look up from her needlepoint and glare, stare me down. She just said it matter-of-factly. And the truth was, I'd never been hymnless. I'm one of those co-alcoholics, when it looks like this one's going south, I'm already working on the next one, right? I had never been without a relationship. And so my sponsor and I agreed that I was going to try to do that. I was definitely needed to extricate myself from the current abusive one I was in. But rather than jumping into the next one, what would it be like if I just tried to work on the steps and try to focus on recovery? And not focus on being in a relationship. I set out to do that for about a year. I didn't quite make it. I made about 10 months, maybe. But when I called him and said, I think I'm ready to date again, he said, oh, great. Get your journal and bring it over. We're ready to do some work then. So we sat down and he said we're going to do a sex inventory, which was going to be different than my fourth step that I'd done. And that was really eye-opening. It was really actually frightening to look at, to see the pattern that I had developed with chasing alcoholics. And so he said, what I want you to do is do a list of an ideal. What is the perfect man for you? What would that look like? And so I did that list, and I came back to him. We sat down. He looked at it, and he started laughing. He started crossing things off. And I'm like, what are you doing? That is my list. You said that was my list. It could be anything I wanted. He said, well, let's look at some of these. How about this one right here? You'd like him to be over 6 feet tall? I'm like, well, you know, because when you're dancing, you know. He said, let me ask you this. Are you over 6 feet tall? Well, no. So you're asking something for nothing. That's called selfishness. Next. When he got finished with that list, all that was left was boring things like kind, considerate, passionate. But he said, now you have a target. So you've been off shooting arrows everywhere and you're not even looking at this target. So he said, now you're ready to date. So your assignment is to go ask someone out on a date. Have you thought about the folks in the room across the hall? I'm like, the AA meeting? Have you lost your mind? That's like shopping in the irregular section. It's like a big scratch and dent sale over there. I don't think so. He said, here's the thing, you're dating alcoholics now. Why don't you try and find one that's actually doing something about it? So I saw one walk by one night on his way into the other room, and I said, oh, I think that's him. He said, well then, get over there. So I came back, I lost my nerve, and he said, did you do it? And I said, no, I didn't do it. I said, I just don't think I'm ready for the whole sex thing. He goes, oh, sex? Did you not understand what I asked? I said, date. Do you know what dating is? And I was like, I think so. He's like, no, I don't think so. See, Solis, it's like a cookie. God is baking the perfect cookie for you in the form of a man. And when he is presented, it will be at the perfect place, at the perfect time, under the perfect circumstances. But until then, it's been your job to work these 12 steps and learn what it is to have patience. To go on a date is to ask someone to coffee or to lunch. You ask them a series of questions. Hopefully they ask questions back, otherwise it's gonna be a very boring date. And at the end of 1 hour, no more, you excuse yourself, you thank them for their time, you each go home to your respective residences, a point you always seem to forget. And the next morning when you're doing your devotional, because that's what he called my morning prayer and meditation, when you're doing your devotional, you ask God, did I gather enough information? And you're only gonna get one or two answers. Either I gathered more information than I ever wanted or needed, or I think I'd like more information. Either way, you pick up the phone, you call them, you say, thank you, I had a really good time yesterday. I feel like I've made a new friend in recovery. I'll see you around at the meetings sometime. You've left no ambiguity about what your intentions are or where it's going from here. Or you call and you say, I had a really good time yesterday. Do you think that we could do that again in a couple of weeks? I'm like, a couple of weeks? He's like, yeah. If this is really going to be a lifetime journey, what's 2 weeks? All right, when you put it that way. So, I still wasn't sure. And I remember talking to him one more time before I got the courage up to ask somebody out on a date. And he said, okay, here's the deal with the cookie. See, you're jumping up and down in front of this oven going, hurry, 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 when will he be ready? And it hasn't occurred to you that it might be getting hot in here. Maybe you're on the inside looking out the glass. Maybe you're the cookie that's not quite ready to be presented yet. And that had never occurred to me. He said, here's the other thing. God is not a pimp. He does not provide a man simply because you want one. This is not Domino's Pizza. He doesn't arrive in 20 minutes or less. And nowhere in the literature will you find the promise of holy matrimony or happy ever after. And I was kind of lost hope at that moment. I was like, what are you saying? Are you saying I'll never have a relationship? And he said, no, what I'm saying is that either that cookie will be presented at the right place at the right time under the perfect circumstances, or God will see to it that you can live a useful and purposeful life without him. That also had never occurred to me. See, in the program of Al-Anon, we have a primary purpose, to help the families of alcoholics recover. What an amazing purpose that is. Think about that for a moment. What an amazing purpose that is. I mean, think of all the people who careen through this life from birth to death and never know what this exercise is about. And each person in this room has been given a gift, the keys to the kingdom, so to speak. We know what it's all about. I have a primary purpose, and at the end of the day, I get to ask myself, did I fulfill that purpose? If I did, I am a success. Wow, what an amazing life. With that primary purpose and with that yardstick of a success, it doesn't matter what the title on my business card is. It doesn't matter what the emblem on the hood of my car is. It doesn't matter who I run with or what zip code I live in. None of those things matter. My life is complete. And all of a sudden, I had a new outlook and attitude upon life, and my life changed. And I got the courage up to go across the hall and ask that guy out on a date. I came back to the Al-Anon meeting, and he said, did you do it? And I said, I did. He has 89 days. He said, you sure can pick him. Now, I had been chasing wet ones for so long, I was thinking catching one that's just damp, recently wrung out, is progress, not perfection. I was happy with myself. I have to tell you, it was the worst date I ever went on. I picked him up, and he's like, oh, is this your car? And I'm like, yeah. He goes, oh, can we put the top up? I really don't like convertibles. I'm like, you know, that's all I drive. I'm like, okay, well, we could put the top up, but we might not be able to enjoy the movie as much. And he's like, what difference does it make on the movie? I'm like, well, we're going to the drive-in. He goes, ooh, can we go to the regular walk-in theater? I don't really like the drive-in. I'm like, I love the drive-in. This is not going well. I said, well, we could go to the regular walk-in theater, but I packed us a picnic dinner, so we wouldn't be able to take it into the theater. And he goes, what's for dinner? I said, turkey sandwich. He goes, oh, I'm vegan. I'm like, oh. We went and saw the worst movie in cinematic history. And halfway through the movie, he said, would you mind just taking me home? And I said, absolutely not. So I'm driving home, and I'm thinking, okay, my sponsor's gonna ask me tomorrow, how did my gathering go? Because I'm supposed to be gathering information. And I'm telling you right now, taking someone to the movies is not a good place to gather information. And we'd been having this conversation about practicing the presence of God and what that means. The idea is that, see, God is there at a moment's notice. The relationship that I built with God is an amazing one. It wasn't at first because I had a lot of issues around God. I used to say, you know, I'm having a hard time with God. I remember saying that one time, and Mary in the corner, the old Scottish woman, said, that would be because, dear, it hasn't occurred to you that God has had a hard time with you. Whatever, Mary. But in this part, in the fourth step, in the Al-Anon 12 and 12, the green book, it says, when we clung to old habits and to unproductive ways of thinking, we block the process of change and flow of inspiration. The surest way to use God's help was to allow solutions to come to us. So, my sponsor pointed out, using God's help. It isn't enough to get God's help. You have to then use it. God gives you the help anytime you ask for it. But what do you do with it? Right? So I had, cleaning house is a requirement to create the space so that amazing things in my life can happen. That's the purpose of working those 12 steps. I once asked him, like, what is the point of all this step work? And he said, it gives you something to do while you're waiting for God to heal you. In and of themselves, the steps will not bring about a spiritual change. Only a relationship with a power greater than myself will. Remember, Al-Anon existed far before they were codified, the steps. There was co-alcoholics meeting in the kitchens while the alcoholics were in the next room, because people were meeting in the homes in the early days of AA, and they were having conversations. And they were having those moments where they felt like somebody else was going through the same insanity that they were. What an amazing feeling that must have been back in 1935 or 36. Really, seriously, if you think about what alcoholism was back then, it was a moral defect. It was certainly not something you ever shared outside of your own home. And now they were gathering in kitchens over coffee, talking about what it meant to be a co-alcoholic and what it meant to be trying to be supportive to an alcoholic spouse. It's amazing. So, the 12 steps, very important, but they give you something to do while you're waiting for God to heal you. And so, I was waiting for God to heal me. So I asked him, do you want to stop and get pie on the way home? And he said, sure. So we pulled into this restaurant, we walked in, the waitress said, we're closed. I was like, of course you are, because that's how this evening's going. And she said, well, no, if you're just going to have pie, I'm closing by myself, so the company would be nice. So I said, okay. So we sat down and I commenced with the questions. We had nothing in common. We tried to talk about politics. I was one party, he was another. He was vegan, I was carnivore. He was a smoker, I was a non-smoker. He just graduated from college, I'd never been to college. He asked me what my interests were, cars. His were museums, art museums. museums. It went, every time we tried to have a conversation, it went nowhere. He asked me what I was currently doing, and I explained I was trying to get my marksmanship ribbon in the military. And so I was spending my time in the afternoon tearing down this rifle and reassembling it and trying to shoot these targets with a specified amount of time and blah, blah, blah. And I could see his eyes roll in the back of his head. So I asked, what are you working on? What are you up to? So he started telling me about this watercolor technique he was working on, how you take the paint and you put it in the water, put the paint brush to the paper, and how it starts to do this organic thing, and then you have to try and manipulate it to get it to do what you want. But as he's telling me, he's getting really excited. I think more excited than anybody should get about painting, really. But in that moment, I was like, oh, passion. That's passion. It's on my list. So I sat up and I started to pay attention, even though I wasn't interested in watercolor techniques. But as he talked and his eyes sparkled and he smiled, I just thought it was the most beautiful thing I'd ever seen. So weeks later, we walk into the meeting hall, holding hands, and then we separate to separate meetings. And the people in my meeting are like, ooh, ooh. And I'm really glad I didn't listen to the naysayers, because in October we'll have 28 years together. And living a life with two programs under one roof is very challenging. The first trip that we made to the marriage counselor, there's been several. The first trip, though, was all around how to argue. We argue very differently. And we learned that, when you get into an argument, your voice will escalate. And if it keeps escalating, eventually you'll get to the nuclear option, which is F you, right? Did you know there's a step above F you? It's called call your sponsor. Oh, no, you didn't. We had to learn those things. It was hard. And we have tried to practice the principles in all our affairs and the traditions in our relationship. There was a wonderful workshop today Carrie Kay gave on traditions in the relationship, and those have been paramount, absolutely paramount. The first tradition, about unity, and I have to recognize what that means is that sometimes I have to compromise. I don't like that word either. Because see, as a co-alcoholic, I'm right. And as soon as you concede that, we will get along just fine. And as good as I am at explaining things, sometimes the sober recovering alcoholic doesn't want any part of it and will walk away. I hate that. And so we had to learn how to argue. We had to learn how to work through our difficulties. And we have what we call in our relationship the hierarchy of recovery, which is God, recovery, marriage, family, good friends, acquaintances, all the way down to material things, right? The problem, if I ever have a problem in recovery today, is when I try and rearrange that order. The truth is, if I don't have recovery, I don't have a marriage. So recovery, unfortunately, does have to come before marriage. If I don't have God, I don't have recovery. So God has to come before recovery. And so when I try and rearrange those things is when I fall into problems. And so I'm trying not to do that these days. Somebody was asking me before the meeting if I was frightened or nervous about getting up here, and I told them no, because everything that could possibly go wrong in a talk has already gone wrong. So, I've had that experience. So in 2000, I was diagnosed with cancer of the bladder. Not a good cancer, but no cancer is really. But when I got through that ordeal, I discovered I have very little control over my bladder. And so my biggest fear has always been, I'll be at the podium, and then I'll be like, I'll be right back. you know, because I don't get much notice at all. And I was in somewhere Texas, and at the podium, and I thought, oh my gosh, here it is, I have to go. And by the time I finished having that thought, it had already happened. And so it wasn't a nice podium like this, it was just a stick, you know. And so there was no hiding it. And I just remember looking out over the Al-Anons and thinking, I wanna die, I wanna cry, I wanna run, but instead I'm just gonna tell the truth. So I explained what had happened. And I want to, you to know that that has sort of become sort of an analogy of my time in the program of Al-Anon. Like all the ugly things that have happened to me in the time that I've been in recovery, I get to deal with you. And you understand. You love me no matter what. No matter what, right? I wound up by asking them, you've all lived with alcoholics. Tell me, you've never seen them wet their pants. And nobody raised their hand. I knew I was good, I kept going. So I knew I was gonna be all right. In 2006, my husband lost his job, and this has been a reoccurring theme in our household, because he has one of those jobs that's sort of contract-based, and so when he's got a contract, we're doing great. When he doesn't have a contract, we're not doing so great. And I talked about this earlier in the meeting today. It was a very difficult time, and so we were in an attorney's office to talk about bankruptcy for him. Because this was before we were legally married. Remember, this was only a few years ago, a couple, 3 years ago, we were allowed to legally get married. So before that, we were just living together in sin. And but we had a lot of commingled finances. So we went to the lawyer's office, and the lawyer said, okay, yes, you definitely qualify for bankruptcy, Rob. So, and then he turned to me and he said, what about you? I said, me? I'm not here. I'm just here to be supportive. And he said, no. See, without marriage, all of the debt that he is going to be absolved of transfers over to you, because much of it is co-debt. Like the cars are in both your names, the credit cards are in both your names, so it's like you've co-signed all his loans. So everything transfers over to you. So your debt to income ratio just went through the ceiling. So you need to be thinking about bankruptcy too. And I remember turning to him and giving him the look. You know, the one we're so good at. It expresses everything we're thinking in this moment. And he said, do you want to keep the house? I said, the house. He said, it's bankruptcy. Everything's on the table. And the house was in my name. So we were driving home. It was the quietest ride home ever. We got home. We got in the door. And I turned on him. And I said, this house is everything to me. It's my security. It's my retirement. And I cannot believe that this has come to this. I don't think we can go on from here. And I walked out. Fortunately for me, my sponsor lived about 10 houses away, so I just walked out and walked down there. And I said, do you know what just happened? And he said, He said, what do you do for a living? I said, I work at the University of California. He said, no, I didn't ask where you worked. I asked, what do you do? Well, I'm a senior administrative associate. He goes, what do you do? I'm like, I work in the Internship and Career Center. He goes, no, that's again back to where you work. What do you do? Well, I maintain files and provide reports. He goes, you're a secretary. I was like, sort of, yes, maybe. He's like, you know, I drive by your house all the time. How many cars you got now? Because remember, I like cars. I said, I think I have about 5. And he goes, I don't know many secretaries that have 5 cars. That's amazing. You should write a book. He said, what you're really saying is Rob, when he's making good money, has given you the kind of life that you've become accustomed to living. And now you want to have a resentment against him that he doesn't provide that for you anymore. We have this thing called the seventh tradition. It's about being fully self-supporting. I suggest you get back over there and you apologize to that man, because he's having a hard day and you are not making it any easier. This is something that co-alcoholics never want to hear, this co-alcoholic, that it might be my fault. See, because when I was When I was living with active using alcoholics, I'm used to that chess game. If you've ever stayed up late at night waiting for an alcoholic to come home, you know what I'm talking about. They're gonna walk through the door, and when they walk through the door, I'm gonna say this, and then they're gonna say this, but I will counter with this, and then I will be ready for this, and I'm gonna come back with them this, and by, I get to checkmate in my mind, right? But it doesn't always work that way. And so we went through bankruptcy. It was a low point in my personal life. Well, the repo man said I was the nicest person he's ever repoed cars from, so I had that going for me. But I also ended up in Phoenix just a little bit later for a conference to speak, and they had a financial recovery workshop at that conference. And I remember going there, and the leader of the workshop said, "We're all going to introduce ourselves, and then we're going to announce how much debt we're in." And I was like, "Oh, my God." I mean, the whole room was like, you know? And she's like, "Yes, because this is the thing that nobody ever talks about, how much money we either have or don't have. And so this is the real honesty part. We're all going to announce what we have or don't have." So I got around to me, and I said, "My name is Solis, grateful member of Al-Anon, co-alcoholic. I am completely 100% debt-free today." And they all applauded. They were like, "Oh my God." And I was like, no, my bankruptcy cleared yesterday. I'm good. And I've just come to discover when you are hot, you're hot. When you are not, you're not. There's really no rhyme or reason to it. I need to be wrapping up. I need to tell you that, so 3 years ago, that's New York, and I'm standing in front of a judge, and he's asking me, "Do you take this cookie to be your lawful wedded husband?" And I never thought that I'd see that day. I never thought it would happen. I didn't know if it was going to happen in my lifetime. But it was an amazing day. It was an amazing experience, and I didn't think that it could get any better, but it has. And my attitude about family and about commitment and about all those things changed on that day. And I want you to know that I believe that good things happen. Good things happen. And it's not always in my time. It's quite frequently in God's time, but they happen. Some amazing things have continued to happen. I got called from the city of Austin, from our city council's office, and they asked me if I would be willing to be a city commissioner. And so I said yes, and so I went down and took my oath of office, and so I help advise the mayors and the city council on LGBTQ issues for our city. And that's a really great opportunity to be of service in a way that I had never anticipated I would get to be of service. And so we were talking, and they were saying, "You know what, we don't have an LGBTQ resource center here in the city of Austin. We should get one of those. Would you help a commission put together to look at getting one started here in the city?" And I said I would. And I didn't think that was going to happen. I was meeting with my boss a few months ago, and he was saying, "How did you get this job?" Because I work for the University of Texas now, and I've been working in higher education for like 25 years, and I still have never been to college. I got accepted to the Naval Academy because they were looking for Latino officers, and when I got arrested, they took it away. They said, "There's a morality clause and you failed it, so you don't get to go to college. We're certainly not going to send you to the academy." So because I'm a defiant co-alcoholic, I simply said, "F you, I won't need you. I will make it through this life without it." But they reminded me about the GI Bill, and so I put money into the GI Bill. And by the time I was ready to go to college and I had a good little nest egg, my mother had a stroke at the bar, and she had no health insurance. And her business folded overnight because of her health. And so I used that money instead to pay healthcare costs. And so by that point, I just gave up. I was like, college is simply not meant to be. So he said, "We know every year in these evaluations that you don't have a college degree, when you're working with all these students, you know, encouraging them to continue their college degree, and you don't have a degree. And I was like, I know. And he's like, well, don't you think you should get one? I was like, nope. Because, like, I'm in my mid-50s, and, like, that train came to the station and flew by. Like, I don't know about you, but I'm retiring in 9 years, 10 months, and 3 weeks. And I have no intention of investing thousands of dollars into something I won't get a return on. And he said, no, I don't think you understand. We're saying you're going to get a degree. And so he said, we're going to rearrange your work schedule so that you can take classes here at the University of Texas, and the University of Texas is going to pay for it, so you have no excuse to not go and get your degree. And I didn't think that was going to happen to me. Through recovery, an amazing life has come together, and I get to watch it every day. It's amazing. And Lois remembers, she's talking about 12-step work with alcoholics, because, you know, Bill in the early days would leave the house and go off to Cleveland or somewhere to talk about Alcoholics Anonymous, but the house was filled with alcoholics. He would bring them home, and then she was left with the alcoholics. And so she was doing AA 12-step work even before Al-Anon was formed. And she's writing in the Lois Remembers about one in particular who has a job interview the next day, and he's trying to convince her that he needs a sedative to go to sleep so he can be ready for this interview. And so she goes out, and she can't get sedatives, it's late at night, so she ends up coming home with some bourbon or whiskey. And so she gives him a shot. And he says, that's it? He said, you can't fly on one wing. And she knew in that moment that he was an alcoholic of the hopeless variety. But I love that analogy about flying on one wing, because I have definitely spent much of my time before I came to the program flying on one wing. And now I have two. And you are certainly all the wind beneath those wings. And the view that I get is my amazing life below me spread out across the horizon. And it's a great view today. I didn't think I'd get this far. You know, when Rob and I in those early days were having those arguments, we'd be right in each other's face, and he'd finally just say, we see things differently. Don't you just love alcoholics when they understate things? It's like, yes, honey, we do. But that's why your book is called As Bill Sees It, and ours is Lois Remembers. Because, honey, she was there, and she wasn't in a blackout. Yes, we see things differently. Don't you just want to pinch their little alcoholic cheeks? I'm going to wrap up with a final story. And that is about an amends. And this was an amends that was made to me. So I was driving with my mother years later. And she had found the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. So we're driving, and she's had this stroke, so she has very little control over her emotions. So she says, I have something to tell you, but I can't tell you now, because she starts crying. So we're driving through Central California. So we get about 50 miles later, and she goes, okay, I think I'm ready to tell you. No, I'm not ready. She starts crying again. We get about 50 miles later, and she finally says, okay, I think I'm ready to tell you. So there's this thing called an amends. And she says, I feel like I robbed you of a childhood. I feel like I was gone all the time, and I left you to raise your brothers and sister. And she said, and I don't know how to make reparations for that. I don't know how you can make restitution on someone's childhood. She goes, if you would tell me what I can do to make it right, I would gladly do that. And I want you to know, I had my hands on the wheel, and I was looking straight ahead, and I started to cry. I started to cry, because as soon as the tear welled up, it like went away. And I turned to her and I said, it's all right, Mom. It's all right. So what was amazing about that exchange to me was that we had rehearsed that conversation many, many times as I was growing up in my head. And in my version, I always exhaled on my cigarette, and I don't even smoke. And I'd said, you're damn right, you're sorry. But from the time that I'd rehearsed the conversation in my head to the time that we actually had it, the miracle that is recovery had taken place in my life and then in hers. And I realized in that moment that I am okay. See, all those experiences I've been labeling bad, horrible, demeaning, whatever label you want to put on them, they actually have value today because of the primary purpose, right? I get to put those to use. You get the families of alcoholics who come in and they're feeling guilt, shame, remorse, and all those feelings that we drag in here behind us. I understand what that is. I understand what that feels like. And I get to have compassion for those people. And I wouldn't have that if I didn't have the program of Al-Anon, if I wouldn't have my experiences. I'm going to wrap up with just a quick prayer that I sometimes say when I think I'm having a bad day. And that is, God, I'm not always what I should be. And there's days when I'm not what I could be. But thank you, God, that I'm not what I used to be. Thank you.